Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Legend has it, underneath the NJM insurance offices lies a room of rejected mascot memorabilia. Is it real? No one knows. But we do know NJM is proud to put policyholders first. No jingles or mascots, just great insurance. NJM.
America, I hope you're ready for this, because I'm talking to Eric Andre today on the three questions. I love him. I love you. I should look at you and tell you that. I should stop talking to America and start focusing on you.
Yes.
Yes. How are you?
Am I here? Is that my entrance?
Yeah.
Or do I still?
That's the Eric Andre theme song. I don't know if you knew that.
Wow. Yeah.
Here he is. Incredible. Here he is, folks. Oh my God, put some pants on. That's a huge dick.
And two vaginas.
Oh my God, huge dick and two vaginas. You must never leave the house. Is one of the vaginas your favorite? Don't tell the other one.
Now you're calling me from a Pier 1 imports.
I am. No, this is those are my plantation shutters, which they still call them that. Even to this day, the wooden shutters.
I'm deeply uncomfortable with those shutters.
Well, I'm deeply uncomfortable with your...
I'm canceling those
with
shutters.
With your honky plants behind you. Hey, listen, your big movie comes out today, right? Or drops, it's as out. They say.
It's out.
That's I noticed that with something, because I was telling my daughter about it, because she's very excited to see it, and I don't know if she was aware that... In fact, just before I got on with you, I was texting her, hey, Eric's movie is officially watchable. And I realized, like, I could have said Eric's movie drops, but like, I didn't have the nerve to say that to my daughter. Like, I just,
you sound like a cool hip hop dad.
But hey man, that drops. It's still one of those things I can't say unironically, you know?
I think you can. You're like a Gen Z hip hop artist. Burgeoning Gen Z hip-hop
The new
artist,
Gen Z Andy me Rick. Has just dropped. like a baby into a birth canal, ready to be shit out into the world. Well, now this is exciting. I'm really looking forward to the movie because it's kind of an interesting amalgam of pranks and story and mania. I haven't seen it yet.
Can I just... interject for a second. I love when you curse.
Oh.
I grew up watching you, and I am just on, like, whenever you say shit or fuck, 13-year-old me goes, oh shit, you slipped that one past the censors.
It's funny because I don't, you know, I probably swear too much. My mother definitely says, like in tweets and on the podcast, she's like, you say fuck all the time. Even though my mother swears like a truck driver, so she really does. She would, I mean, like I used to call, like when I was in college, I would call home, and I have a younger brother and sister who are 9 years younger, and she'd be on the phone. She'd be like, yeah, uh-huh. So I told your Uncle Bill, hold on a second. Will you kids shut the fuck up? Anyway, so I told your uncle. Like that was our everyday in our house. Shut the fuck up. I'm trying to fucking talk on the phone. Jesus. Oh, boy. Now, where'd you grow up? I can't remember. I had research on you.
I grew up in suburban Florida, Boca Raton, Florida. And I resent my parents to this day for dragging me there. But I was 3 years old. I had no say in the decision.
Yeah, Boca was always, whenever I got on a plane to go from Newark to Florida, it was Boca was seemed to be where the people in matching, like the middle-aged people in matching tracksuits were going, you know, like lots of
It's more like elderly swingers in Hawaiian.
Really? Shirts. Is it truly swingers?
It's like golf. It's like old Long Island and New Jersey people retirees. Yeah.
How did your family end up there?
My mom is a Jew from New York. My dad is from Haiti. My dad escaped Haiti in 1969-70 because there was a dictatorship going on. It was a bad scene.
Yeah.
Went to New York, married my mom. They had my sister. Then he went to, my dad's a psychiatrist, went to med school in the Caribbean, finished his residency in Miami. I think they got their house broken into a couple times in Miami. It was the 80s.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But like, he escaped a dictatorship. New York in the 70s was crime ridden. Miami in the 80s was crime ridden. And he just asked the doctors, he's like, can I just go to like a boring suburban? Where's a boat? Like, I want to like be like close to a metropolitan area, but like get me to the suburbs. And one of his doctor student
colleagues.
Buddies was like, Boca colleagues. Yes. One of his colleagues was like, I hear Boca is nice. And he's like, sold. As long as my house doesn't get broken into, I want to like avoid crime. Yeah. But for me, like a spastic mixed kid in this environment and just being like ADD and everything else, I was very bored and I felt very out of place and I resented
it. I bet. And were you born there or were you born in Miami?
I was born in Miami. And then when I was three, they moved up there. So really I grew up there, but then I got the hell out as soon as I turned 18. I went to college in Boston, then moved to New York.
Did you get in trouble a lot? I mean, were you, and also too, I mean, is it a racist place? I mean, as a mixed kid,
Florida?
No, but, you know, I mean, it varies from town to town. Racist. You know what I mean? Of course, Florida's racist.
No, yes, a lot of racism, a lot of like casual racism, just like hard R N bombs dropped casually in conversation. And you're like, wait, what? Come again. Yeah, and you have to be like, yeah, is that normal? But here's how it works. Yes, there's plenty of racism. The farther you went north in my county, the more you stretch towards central Florida, the more Confederate flags and overt racism you would see. So I moved to Boston for college. I was like, I'm sick of this racism. Yeah. I'm going to a place where there's not a single racist. Boston, Massachusetts. Let me meet a nice Red Sox fan.
That is pretty funny. Well, it probably did. You know, it was different, but it still made you feel like you were home. You know, it was like there was just enough racism to make you comfy.
It's very segregated. It's very segregated by race and class. And I didn't and never felt like I fit in.
Did your dad like it or was he just happy to not have his car broken into?
I think he my dad has PTSD from Haiti. And I think he liked being in this like a safe and predictable and boring. I think he liked the boredom.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, this is like, he like grew up in chaos. Yeah. This is really kind of dark. When he moved to New York and he married my mom and they had my sister, they were in Queens and my mom got like strangled in an elevator by some psychopath.
Oh my God.
She didn't tell me this till later. This is kind of dark. Sorry if this is like not off tone for you.
It's okay.
But, and my mom tells it very casually. She was like, hey, it's New York. I grew up in New York. Whatever. I went on the elevator. This guy comes in. He strangles me till I pass out. He just stole my purse. No big deal. They took me to the hospital, but nothing was wrong. You know, she shrugs everything off. She's like, I've been mugged 50 times. Whatever. But I think like my dad was like, I finally escaped Haiti. And then he turns around and his wife is being strangled. So he's like, fuck, I got to get out of here. So they like. And then he went to med school in the Dominican Republic, which isn't the safest place on earth. He's like, I gotta get out of here. Then he went to Miami in the 80s. And it was like,
yeah.
And he's like, I gotta get the fuck out of here. Like, why can't I just find a place where there's not like my wife's not being strangled? Like, there's not bullets flying everywhere. My house isn't getting broken into. I think he was just like, I need, like, I want a boring place. Get me the fuck. Yeah. I'm just like, my dad's like very like bashed, like quiet bookworm nerdy. Yeah. Guy, And he just doesn't, like, I think he never felt like he belonged in any of these places.
You got to give him that slack, because it is like, okay, all right, that's, we get it. Because I mean, I have that desire to live somewhere boring, but that's just because I'm old now. You know what I mean? It's like, as you get older, you do just kind of be like, a fancy restaurant? Seen it. You know, like, can I, how easy is it to park? Like, that kind of shit becomes like, okay, all right, yeah, that's fine, that'll do.
I feel like that now. I'm turning 38 next week, and I feel like
that's
that now.
About, like, when it starts. Yeah, where you're just like,
I'm like partied out.
Yeah.
Also, hangovers last really long. Mm-hmm. Like, remember when you were in your 20s and a hangover would just like last just the morning, and you would get a coffee and a sausage, egg and cheese, and you'd be back at the bar the next night. It's hangover's an all day affair. It's like, I have to plan the next day.
I went a couple of times. I went to work still tripping just a little bit. I mean, moving furniture, you know, I mean, which is like not bad if you're tripping, because you don't have to.
Oh, I thought you meant like.
Oh, no, no, not Conan. No, no, no. No. I found early on that, I would never trip and do a show, but I found out just from doing improv shows in Chicago, like a beer or a drink, okay, but like just even a little bit of weed fucking throws a wrench into all the works, because all it does is make me question every word that's coming out of my mouth, you know?
It gets you in your head, and the last place you want to be when you're on.
Yeah. And the worst part is it's a waste of weed. That's the thing. It's like, fuck, I could have saved this weed for after the show and enjoyed it rather than have it stress me out. But that's the same thing. All that stuff, hangovers, like, you know, like just like now, I don't even drink enough now to where I get a hangover, because I just, I can't, like, to wake up the next day and have a headache for 6 hours. I'm furious at myself.
It's a waste of a day.
Yeah.
And you can just age out of that shit.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to, but my body's just like, fuck you. Why did you poison me?
Well, now, what do you think? I mean, your mom and dad sound like, like opposites in many ways. I mean, aside from just the sort of like physicality of them, but just also, it sounds like your mom's personality is not shy and bookish.
Oh man, how do I describe my parents? My mom looks like Fran Lebowitz. Mm-hmm. My dad looks like Arthur Ashe, or like a dark skinned Colin Powell. And just to get a visual,
sure.
One, and
now I'm picturing them doing it.
I have video actually that I want to send you. And they've been divorced for 25 years, so it was really hard to
get them to fuck.
They're married for 25 years, they've been divorced for about 25 years, but they're still friends, and they're both like very kind of nerdy and bookwormy, and then that's kind of all they have in common. They love politics and they love reading, and then that's and they're both a little bit spectrumy, or just kind of like the social interaction dial is like not totally like set right. It's a little bit like off, you know, like a little bit too like left brain lopsided, kind of
like they're not completely in tune with the human language, like just the sort of the entirety of the language of human interaction. Is that what you mean? Like out in public. I mean, I don't mean like to their children even so, but just like.
I think it's, I mean, I'm diagnosing them and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but some sprinkling of like Asperger's or, Alana Glazer told me a new term called neurodivergence, which I barely understand, but they might have a little bit of like neurodivergent going on, but then both super academic. I don't know. They're strange to me. I'm still figuring out my parents. And they're kind of like mysterious.
Was the divorce made easier by their kind of lack of emotionality between the two of them, or?
No, I was actually, I was blindsided by the divorce. They were just like, they never fought. They're very like conflict averse, but so much so that they don't like deal with their emotions in a healthy way. They just kind of like suppress them and they're quiet about them. And they just like, especially my dad, just like keeps it under the surface. And then one day he's like, I'm divorcing your mom. Bye. And I was like, what? I mean, you know, I was 12. I'm turning 38. 26 years later, I still kind of have whiplash.
Really? Wow. Yeah.
So they are confusing to me.
Yeah.
They're confusing. I think my dad kind of grew up in a very chaotic country and had to suppress a lot of stuff out of like a survival tactic, maybe.
Yeah. And probably, I imagine when you go through that kind of childhood that he did, giving your well-fed, well-housed kid a soft landing because you're married, it's just not in his makeup to be like, I better make this easy on the kids, because he's like, well, hey, the kids aren't getting shot at. It's, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and also like, my dad was very like aloof with me and my sister. He wasn't like very involved. He never like came to high school functions or like anything like that. But that, and we've confronted him about it over and over again. But like, he's like, compared to his father, he's like, his dad like didn't even know he existed until he was like 20.
Oh, wow.
you know what I mean? Like, and he had like big Catholic family. So he had like 70 siblings. I have like 10 million cousins and aunts and aunties and uncles. And just like, there's no condoms in the first 20, what's happened in the 20th century, 80. Yeah. No, like condom,
right?
The Pope would kill us.
Well, do you think you get part, like, where from out of that union, where does your sense of humor, like, how do they produce somebody that, you know, whose sense of humor is as unique as yours? You know,
I grew up kind of glued to the television. And I felt kind of out of place, but I was also very hyperactive. And growing up in the 80s, all that we ate for breakfast and lunch was sugar. All they gave kids, it was like Frosted Flakes, Ninja Turtle cereal, apple juice, orange juice, Capri Sun, orange slices. This is like the first half of the day. It's just sugar. I'm not getting any nutrients. Yeah. I'm like just bouncing off the wall. Blah, 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 blah. Then you got to school, and school lunch was pizza and like soda and chocolate milk.
So more carbs.
Yeah, just sugar and sugar and sugar. Finally, when I got home from school and then we had dinner, I would have like a salad and like some food. And that was like my only real nutrients of the day. So I think like just my diet was all sugar. I was hyperactive. I felt out of place. And I was just like glued to the television all the time and just like emulating every cartoon and every comedy show. I was just obsessed with comedy.
Yeah.
Even though I went to music school, obsessed with comedy and just like trying to make my friends crack up at school. I don't know.
Now you went to Berklee in Boston, the School of Music. So you obviously were pretty, because that's hard. That's a hard place to get into.
It used to be. I think back in like the 40s, 50s, 60s, when it was like this like elite jazz program, because it was one of the earliest jazz schools. And then I think in the 90s, they figured out, why are we elite if we just like let any schmucky 18-year-old in who's got the cash, just let the floodgates open. Let's make some dollars, baby. It was like a 75% acceptance rating. All I did was like write an essay, get a couple of letters of recommendation from some high school teachers, and like do like a cool jazz solo on my bass. And they're like, yeah, come on in. And I was like, oh man, I got in. And then when I got there, like half the people there, like couldn't even read music. And they just like most of my friends were not good musicians. Right. They just grabbed the jazz. Come on in. They're just like suckering 18-year-olds into a dream of being a rock star. It's like, then 4 years later, after your hacky sacks all exploded, and like you come out of a fog of weed and Jägermeister, you're like, I just wasted $120,000
on jazz.
on jazz.
Mom, I spent all my money on jazz.
like a form of music that hasn't been relevant for like 100 years, and you're fucking 18 when you make that decision. You don't know, and then you go to the workforce at 21, 22, and you're like, jazz was a bad choice.
Well,
my resume just said doobie doobie doobie.
March into spring with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered 500 megabits internet for $39.99 per month, plus a $100 gift card and price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with a free modem, free installation, and free Wi-Fi your way home. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and manage user access for all connected devices with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires May 6, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
If there's anything better than getting a few of your favorite things from McDonald's, it's getting a few of your favorite things from McDonald's for less in the McDonald's app. Delicious. Order in the McDonald's app today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Right now, only in the app. Enjoy a breakfast sandwich for just $1, like a sausage McMuffin with egg. Offer valid one time per day from 4/29 to 5/12/24 at participating McDonald's. Must opt into rewards.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Through the whole thing, are you thinking like I'm going to be a jazz bassist? Or, I mean, you started doing some comedy stuff, right?
The thing, though, towards the end, the whole experience was very I always called it my quarter life crisis. It was a existential dilemma the whole, all 4 years of college. I was like, in a band, I think by the time we finally got on our feet, we played like 3 shitty open mics and never got anywhere. But as I was doing these open mics, I would see flyers for like, you know, open mic comedy night, come on down, tell jokes. And I just had that spark. I was like, should I try it? It seems terrifying.
Yeah.
And till this day, I'm still terrified of comedy. Every time I perform, you've seen me on Conan, just flop sweating every time. I could go on an audition for a non-union regional ham commercial and still be like, oh, fuck, man. Did I fuck that up, man?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm just like, I'm an anxious guy. So, but I just tried it. I just started doing stand-up towards the end of college. You know, Boston and Chicago, they're both very like comedy towns. Like a lot of Toronto, Chicago, Boston, yeah. I feel like a lot.
Yeah, the early Conan show is pretty much 50-50 Chicago, Boston. Yeah, in terms of the writing staff, you know, a few other geographies thrown in, but really Chicago, Boston.
That makes sense. I think Boston, Chicago might have this too. It's like the I'm sure your writing staff was like that perfect tornado of neurotic, obsessive Jews and Irish Catholics that just suppress and suppress.
Yeah, pretty close.
And drink and suppress. But that's what comedy comes from. That like Catholic suppression and Jewish neurosis combined too is like beautiful in a writer's room. It's like bouquets of flowers. That's my comedic metaphor right now that I'm abandoning as I'm saying it. Like come out of that, those two psychological dispositions. But back to my story. Yes, I just started doing stand-up towards the end of college, and I fell in love with it. And I started filming prank videos around other colleges because there's so many colleges. I would go to Boston University and do pranks there and go to BC and do pranks there. And I just realized as I was graduating, like, I should pivot and make comedy. I felt like if you were a great musician, a virtuoso guitar player, or a brilliant songwriter, you would still potentially see a life of poverty. There was no rhyme or reason to the music industry. But if you were really good at comedy, you would find a job somewhere. You might not be a movie star, but you'll get like a decent gig somewhere if you're really funny. So I felt like comedy made more sense.
Yes, that was your fallback. That was your fallback from jazz, was comedy.
Yeah, I go, Dad, you know, as I'm like wasting all my parents' money on jazz school. I'm like, Dad, you know, I'm finishing school. I got my degree in music, but I already quit. I'm getting into, and he's like, please say law school or med school. And I go, I'm getting into comedy. And my dad was like, why? He actually, when I first moved to New York, right, as I graduated school, he talked me into taking the LSATs, and he paid for a tutor. He was like, I'm going to find you a tutor. You're going to take the LSATs. And I studied for 6 months for the LSAT. And I got to the test and I looked down at the Scantron, and the proctor was like, if anybody has any other last questions before we get started, ask them now. And I just looked down at that Scantron and I broke my pencil in half, and I got up and I just left. And I was like, comedy for life.
I went right to the tattoo parlor and got that on my gums. Comedy for life.
And then I was just like, flat broke for a decade. You know what? I feel proud that I, because like right when I graduated, my mom, my dad were like, pushed all my student loan debt to me. They were like, good luck. They just like kicked it over to me. And then finally, when I sold the Eric Andre Show and I did season one of the show, I proudly called Sally Mae and I was like, here's your whatever, $50,000 back, lady. Yeah.
I'm not a lady, sir.
I proudly paid off my student loans and I felt like so.
Yeah.
I did it, man. I did it my way.
Yeah. Now, when you start doing stand up, I mean, is there like, because so much of what you do, well, I mean, you know, you have people walk off your show because they don't know what the fuck is going on. And was that that kind of aspect of making an audience say, wait, what is this? Is this guy serious? What am I watching here? Was that?
No, the audience I want on my side. When I'm pranking somebody on my show, the audience, which is not like actually there, we don't really have a live studio audience in for the Eric Andre Show, but you know, the television viewer at home is on my side. I'm lighting up the guest for their laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
So, no, I'm not pushing the audience away in this weird like German avant-garde theater of Andy Kaufman shit. I'm the opposite. I'm like begging the audience to like me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm much less cool, much more pathetic.
Yeah, but well, the things you do, you know, I mean, just a lot of the, you know, desk smashing and, you know, I mean, it's pretty confrontational stuff. So it's like, did you reach a point where you knew your audience would be with you? Like, you obviously have to have some kind of trust in your audience and some faith in you know, in like some of the stuff that you do. Or do you just like, are you doing what you think is funny and you know there's just enough people that share your sensibility?
I didn't know if anybody was going to get it when we did the first season of the show.
Yeah.
And then when we had that first episode 101 up on its feet, I showed my buddy Zach, who's very like, he like doesn't bite his tongue. I kind of showed him on purpose because he'll tell me if something sucks or not. And I remember he looked up from that 11 and a half minute episode and he goes, the kids are going to love this one, man. And I was like, oh, that's a good sign. And then so I started feeling good and showing more and more people. And then when we went on that first tour for the Eric Andre Show, I remember telling myself, like, it's okay if you don't, like, sell out these venues. Like, you're getting your start. And I just read this article about, like, the first time this band At The Drive-In played in New York City. Like, they were like, we finally made it to New York, man. And they went in the venue and, like, they played for one person. They just played for the bartender. Like, it was a completely empty.
Yeah.
So I was like, there might be some shows like that. But the first Eric Andre Show tour, we weren't playing the biggest venues ever. We were playing these like punk rock, more intimate venues. But the whole, we did like probably 10 cities. And they were all sold out, like lying around the block.
That's great.
And they were like, that was like my first real fans, you know? So I was like, okay, I think I might be on something. Like, I think that this is, and then, you know, slowly but surely you start getting recognized at the bar and the restaurant. Yeah, yeah.
You become an egomaniac. You start being
a maniac,
pushing the people closest to you furthest away, you know, all the standard stuff. I do want to go. I want to go back because, like you said, you had that decade of being broke.
Yeah.
And I don't. People that aren't sort of, you know, that aren't in show business or aren't in comedy, you know, they hear people say that, but I don't know if they realize it's like, it's one thing to be young and starting your career and broke, but it's like, I think there's something about show business because there's so few opportunities. Like it's such a seller's market when it comes to jobs that it's kind of crazy. Like for a decade you waited and what went through your mind? I mean, were there doubts? You know, there had to be.
I just was full of piss and vinegar. And there's something about being in your 20s in New York City where you're just resilient. You can like survive off like 4 hours of sleep and drinking bourbon till 4 a.m. And like I said, like the Dunkin' Donuts sausage, egg and cheese can just like keep you going for like 12 hours. Like I was just like, I was determined. And I worked shitty day jobs in cubicles and I temped and I just like, and I just would look around those offices and just be like, I was like, this can't be my life. I won't allow it. Like life has to be enjoyed. I have to do something I enjoy. So I think I was just determined, but I was fucking broke. Like I would go, me and my buddy Julio, who also moved, he was my high school friend. We moved to New York at the same time. I like rented out my, I rented this apartment for 6 months. With the other high school buddy. And then like Julio came to town and I was like, I'll give you my apartment if you pay me back the rent and I'll live off that money and I'll just like couch hop. And I slept outside in the park a couple nights, which was terrifying. And like, I would like do open mics and ask the audience if I could sleep over after the show and shit like that. I would like sleep over at people's houses that I barely knew. And we would like go, there was this place called Punjabi Deli on First and First in the Lower East Side. And they sold $2 microwave Indian food. It was the cheapest meal you could get in New York. And I like lived off that. And it was just like, they would like microwave it in the styrofoam. Like I definitely like ate like melted plastic. The styrofoam.
Yeah.
Like, and this is pre Uber, this is pre smartphone. This is like all the New York City taxi drivers would eat there. So it's just me and my friend Julio and like 19 taxi drivers. And we would just be all eating the shittiest, like I'm definitely, it was like eating like pollution from the ocean. Like,
yeah.
And fill your stomach and it was cheap. And I would get $2 falafels. I was broke. Yeah. I was so broke. And I had like my shitty bicycle and I bike all sweaty. I was just like sweaty and like oozing toxins.
in your sort of moments of doubt, I know I had them, like this isn't going to work. I got to do something else. You know? Yeah. I just sort of confront with like the death of my dreams and me having to be a grown up. And I mean, did you go through that? And what did you see your life being? Because I also heavily relate to the, I got to have fun. I can't. Sitting in an office, the few times that I had a job that was kind of an office environment, I just was like, I'm going to fucking die in here. I'm going to be, I'm going to like be addicted to every substance and be 600 pounds if I stay here. You know, what did you think you were going to do with yourself if comedy didn't work out?
I, you know,
have to shamefully go back to jazz with your tail between your legs.
with my saxophone between my legs. I don't know. I was like doing, I really enjoyed the stand-up comedy scene in New York and like the camaraderie that I had with my like circle of friends in the comedy community. So I think that kept me going. And I felt like good about my stand-up. Like my stand-up was, I felt like it was getting better and I was getting more comfortable on stage. So I did feel like growth. So that kept me going. And then I did this like, this live stand-up comedy competition called NBC Stand Up for Diversity, where they'd have all like the people of color, you know, like up and coming POC comedians would like compete against each other for like a chance to go to LA and perform in front of agents. Yeah. And
I was like, that's what the man always wants. He wants to pit colored people against each other.
That's right.
That's what he's always doing.
So I did that and like I got an agent that didn't do a goddamn thing for me for another 10 years. But and then I went back to New York and there was like there was a little bit of forward momentum each year.
Oh, okay.
That kept me going.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was making any money, but like I felt like I was honing my craft. So and then I made like a really the poor man's version sizzle reel of the Eric Andre show on my own dime when I was like 26, 27, and then sold it to Adult Swim by 28. So then I had a job, but that was like, I was just nearing like 10 years of.
Right. Right.
I would have like waves where I'd have like some money and then I'd like kind of go through it and then be broke and then like get like a, whatever. I'd get like a, some fucking
corporate gig or something.
Eisen Wireless, you know, or like, you know, allergy medicine commercial or something. And that would like give me my like 19,000 bucks that I would live off of for the
year.
Plus temp jobs and stuff like that. So there was little fits and starts where I would see like a glimmer of some kind of career.
And I think that's very important. And for people that like are thinking about like about doing this, you know, young people listening to this thinking, that is, you know, there is the difference between toiling in obscurity and toiling in obscurity with gradual progress that you can be honest with yourself and really truly see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did your stand-up have the pranks aspects of it, or was that just that was just kind of a side thing that you did when you started to do the TV show?
I was always doing pranks, even back in the early days, like as I was finishing school in Boston, I would film like crude hidden camera pranks that like were the kind of primordial ooze of the pranks that went on the show. I don't even know if I have them anymore. They might be on like a VHSC, which is like a micro VHS tape in my mom's garage somewhere. But stand up. No, I was definitely like, same point of view and that absurdist, almost that like kind of chaotic 70s Robin Williams, like just bouncing off the walls, you know, Steve Martin absurdity, you know, where I might do things where I would like go out into the audience or like drag the audience outside and bring them back in, like that kind of like Kaufman-esque anarchy. Yeah. But not like pranks on stage.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. It ultimately, I'm thinking, is a dumb question. Because, of course, you can't prank people who are coming.
I was insulted when you asked me that.
I was so sorry.
That was bullshit, actually. You spit in my face.
I am so sorry. Well, I do want to know. I do want to know because there is, you know, you talked about the same sort of comic ethos is that was in your stand-up that's in the show. And a lot of what you do, especially like in the beginning, it seemed like you set out like you were doing a talk show, and it seemed like the first step you did was like to take an axe and chop away at the very idea of a talk show, you know, like blowing up the desk every once in a while, being rude, being nude, being, you know,
subdued.
Yeah.
I hope you were rapping for a second.
Only a second. I can only do it for a second.
You are a Gen Z hip hop.
I can only rap for a second, and then I get real tired and fall down. But is that, like, where does that come from? Like, is it a love of the form? Is it that the form is so, I mean, played out? Because I know in 93, when we started doing a talk show, there was a lot of like, well, what the fuck else is there to do with a talk show?
Right. It didn't come out of like, Howard Stern asked me that too, and I answered wrong and I regretted it. It didn't come out of like, I hate talk shows. It wasn't like, it didn't come out of anger. It actually came out of my love of mock talk shows. I love Ghost. I love Jiminy Glick, Martin Short, when he did Jiminy Glick. I loved Ollie G's show. I loved, it was like, my show was like a derivative of a derivative, not like watching, I wasn't watching Steve Allen or Johnny Carson, like, fuck them. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean. Although that's not, that can be a very valid point to take. But anyway,
it came more out of like my influence of, I just loved how bizarre and absurd Space Ghost was and how like the guests didn't even matter. It was so like Space Ghost was like self-absorbed and like arguing with Zorak. And like I love that, like the guests would just sit there and wait for them to be responded to. And it was so surreal. Same with the Martin Short and Ollie G show. It was like, I was more just like a sum of my influences than like speaking out against Jay Leno. You know what I mean? It didn't come from that. It's the oldest, it's one of the oldest television formats. Yep. So it's like, it's a perfect template to subvert from.
Yeah.
I think that like, you know, the news and the Steve Allen and the Tonight Show are like, just like in the American, like, they're just like in our bones. Mm-hmm. They're in our DNA. So it's like an easy structure to put my absurdity.
Yeah.
Over.
Yeah. Well, it also too, it is like, you know, when you look back on it, and you, especially when you think about how important it used to be, like, you know, Johnny Carson would talk to Gina Lola Brigida for three acts, you know, like, and that show was an hour and a half, I think, like every night.
Yeah, it's like high, high status. Yeah. So it's like perfect high status show, high status construct to put me, which is this like anarchic caveman, into.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? So, well, no, it's like the fancy party that you get to go, like, you know, fall into the cake, basically. You know, yeah. And that is like, because, you know, having been on a talk show for a million years, and I, you know, having been around, you know, it's like lots of like paying homage to Johnny Carson. And I always am like, I didn't care about Johnny. That was like what my grandma watched. And even then, not that much. Right. And I mean, for me, it was always David Letterman. And the thing I like about David Letterman is like his bottom line was like, look at how stupid this all is. Like, all of this means nothing, you know? And you know, what you're doing is saying like, it more than means nothing. I mean, it's like, it's from a different planet, and it means nothing. Yeah. So,
yes.
When this show have you ever been contacted by anybody to do like? Have they ever said like, "Well, do you want to do like a real interview kind of thing?" Like, has anyone ever
like a real talk show?
Yeah, yeah.
No, but I always like. I look at Colbert, and it's funny because he did a mock talk show in a sense, like Colbert Report
in character.
He was like. He was this bizarro Bill O'Reilly character that he created. And then he like got David Letterman's job, and he had to like, there was a moment where he had to like recalibrate. Like that first year he was like, I can't do the fake Bill O'Reilly persona. Cause that doesn't make sense. And I like saw how he like struggled and had to figure out like, what is my new kind of like POV that's more me. And I kind of like have fantasized about that. I would be like, how funny and ironic would it be if like later in life I was actually offered like a real talk show job.
Yeah.
How would I cope with that? What would I,
what would I do? But maybe it might not be that much different.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like, I wouldn't want to be balls to the wall. I mean, like, my show is like my pure id. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be that, but no one has offered, but like something nice about having a consistent job rather than going out with like different acting jobs. I like envy you and Conan and Letterman and Colbert. Like you just get, you don't have to worry about it. Like, oh fuck, I got to memorize my lines for this thing. And it's a new, and it's like, oh, I got to like audition for that. And it's like all over the place. Like there's something like your body likes, I just read A Short Guide to a Long Life. Mm-hmm. Your body likes consistency.
Yep.
And like going to bed at the same time every night. And like that's what we evolved to do. So like part of me, I think, would like take the job. Not that I'm being offered the Tonight Show or anything. Like when I did it, that thought has crossed my mind before. And I was like, I actually would take it, especially if it was like later down the road. I would like, I'm tired. I'm
really
38 and I'm like exhausted. So I can't imagine 58. If I would want to like be bouncing all around. I'm like flying out to South Carolina to film something soon. Like, I think I'd want to just like same time every day. Like, I'd enjoy that.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, now, the movie you said it took 4 years to make.
Seven
years to make. Were you shooting those whole 7 years?
I would say the first 3 years kind of don't count. So, like, 4 years from when we, like, had a story that was more or less the story that stayed in the movie and went out to the market and pitched it and got a bag of money from a company to make it. That was 4 years. But it was three years of developing the idea.
Yeah.
Add it to the before the 4 years that make it a full 7 years. But what was your question? Sorry.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
I've never done press for a movie before. I feel like run over by and it's been 7 years, so I've had insomnia for a month leading up to today. Like, I cannot sleep. It's just so...
Because it comes out today.
Yeah, it's coming out. Yeah, it's out right now. So, like, my brain is just, like, my organs are, like, grinding and just, like...
Yeah.
I feel like... And I've been drinking a little bit more in quarantine. Let's be honest.
Let's be honest. All right. Finally. You know, this is an intervention. Your mom's on the line, too.
Bubba.
No, doing press is it's the one thing that like you don't even think about. Like, you might fantasize about like giving interviews, but then the actual reality of it is something nobody ever signed up for. Dude, saying hard. The same shit all day, every day.
It's hard, and I feel this pressure to be on, you know. Yeah. And it's like doing,
you're selling.
Yeah, it's like doing a 12-hour stand-up comedy set every day for like months. Like, I'm just like, I was like in bed and I was just like, I couldn't sleep, and I was just like, I was making these weird like car noises. Like, girlfriend's like, are you all right? And I was just like, And I just like, I was in pain that I couldn't describe. And I was like, am I getting sick? And I like, checked my temperature. And I was like, I'm not getting sick. And I'm like smelling garlic to make sure I don't have COVID. And I'm like, you know, I'm just like, I hurt. Everything hurts. The pressure of like the just the anxiety of like, I've been waiting 7 years. And, you know, we were supposed to premiere at South by Southwest last year. So this was the existential. This was the depressing part of it. Supposed to finally, after 6 years last year, We're going to premiere at South by Southwest. We had the headlining. No, before that, we're supposed to premiere October 2019 at the Toronto Film Festival. We got into TIFF. Hell yeah. Then the studio pushed the movie to February because they saw some other movie that we weren't even fucking competing with. I'll tell another day. Pushed it to February. And then we go, no, we'll push to April so that we can get into South by Southwest. Got into South by Southwest. Headliner, whatever, like Friday night, like the prime time spot. We had a big prank plan for the red carpet. A global pandemic. Mm-hmm. After 6 years, a global pandemic shuts down South by Southwest. I mean, I was like 5 days away from flying to Austin, Texas, and finally having this red carpet. And like South by Southwest, that's the best audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those like Texan hipsters just fucking love comedy and music and like, they would have been the perfect audience to just been like howling at the movie and just having that moment. Finally, after like five seasons of Eric Andre's show and building up towards this movie and a global pandemic.
Yeah.
Shuts it down 5 days before I fly to Austin. So then, and then the movie's nowhere. And then the theaters get shut down. It was supposed to be theatrically released. It wasn't at Netflix. Then theaters get shut down. And then, like, the pandemic was supposed to be, like, 2 weeks or whatever at first. And then it's like, did we say 2 weeks? We meant 2 years, probably. So I was just... and then finally we sold it to Netflix. Because it was, like, it was in the graveyard for a second.
Right, of course, yeah.
So we sold it to Netflix, which is, like, the best venue in town, especially right now after quarantine.
Right.
And then, Netflix was never giving us a date. And I was like, is this movie going to come out in 2023?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm used to Eric Andre's show, which is an instant gratification, like late night or tonight show, like, but much quicker than 7 years.
Sure.
I'm not even sure if I stand by some of these jokes and these pranks anymore. Like, the comedy evolves every year.
And the world
is in a different place every year. So you're right. I shot this like 4 years ago. I don't even remember. I haven't seen the lock cut since we delivered it 2 years ago. So I'm like watching it for the first time in a long time. You know?
Yeah.
So it's been an emotional whirlwind.
Mm. Well, I think we found the greatest tragedy of the pandemic.
I can't complain.
I know. It's the same thing. It's like, I can't, like, wait a minute. You got to stay home and you still did your TV show and got paid for your TV show, mostly staying home. And then when you got really bored with staying home, you did your TV show from a theater that you've been going to for 20 years, who you know and love everyone there. Yeah. Like, I have no room to complain. Yeah. It's been kind of like a nice break from just almost all responsibilities. Totally. You know? I'm kidding. But yeah, that really sucks. And it mainly sucks because the movie, and I haven't seen it yet. I went to bed too early. I was like, I was going to watch it at midnight.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But I was like, nah, I'll watch it later. Cause I want to watch it with my daughter. Cause she's going to love it.
Yes. So much, I hope she's not 7 years old because it is.
She's 15.
Okay.
She's
hard R. It's hard R.
Probably one of the things Jackass movies is probably like one of our, like, just it's like, can't think of anything. Just put on Jackass. Yeah. We just watch the Jackass movies.
Primal gut-busting laughter.
Yeah, it's the funniest stuff in the world.
And they're hot, too. Somebody goes, you know what else Jackass works? I'd fuck every single one of those guys.
Yeah. It's always kind of like my daughter asked once, like, why do they always have their shirts off? And I'm like, because they look like that. Yes, it's like, if I look like that, I'd have my shirt off all the time, too, for fuck's sake. If I look like Bam Margera.
I've been drinking so much. I have, like, pickle tits and a jelly belt. It's just like,
I know.
It's like a suckling pig.
I lost 40 pounds in 2019. Yeah, it was started out being stress pounds that I then sort of, like, turned lemons into lemonade and lost weight. And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, I'm going to climb into a loaf of bread and live here.
Yeah.
And so I did. And all that 40 pounds, I found it again.
Yeah, it's impossible. You know? It's like that Jerry Seinfeld joke. He's like, you realize when you're an adult, like, I can go to the store and buy as many cookies as I want.
Yeah.
And it's like terrifying. Like, you can buy as many cookies as you mm-hmm. want and eat as many cookies as you want. Yeah. No one will stop you. That's like,
yep.
Like we're primates. We don't have that much self-control.
Yeah. No, not at all. Nobody's going to see me eating another two pieces of pizza.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to notice that.
I'm so bad with self-control. I can't. Yeah. And it's so hard not to beat yourself up about it, but sugar tastes so good. I have a sweet tooth.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's a global, it's a once in a lifetime global pandemic. I think we have to, my therapist is like, I think we have to give ourselves a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
During a once in a lifetime global pandemic.
Yes.
I should say hopefully once in a lifetime, but like this isn't a normal thing. So crawl into a loaf of bread. Like,
be kind to yourself.
Yeah. Be kind to yourself. You can't beat yourself up during this nightmare Twilight Zone episode.
Right. Well, what do you think going forward? What's, you know, this is the three questions. What do you think going forward for you? Are you kind of holding your breath to see how the movie goes? And that's kind of,
yeah. I mean, the movie coming out today, it's out. Definitely want to see how the definitely depending on how that goes, will shape a lot of things.
Yeah.
In any direction. So, want to see this like wave of it throughout the next month, throughout April, and kind of make that decision. I have a bunch of ideas. I have some like, you know, hidden camera prank ideas, television ideas, film ideas, scripted ideas, and I'm filming something over the summer. So after I'm done filming and also seeing how the movie did throughout the spring and summer, then I'll kind of pick my head up and figure out the next steps. I have a couple things, but I'm weirdly superstitious. I'm the most superstitious atheist I've ever met. I'm like, God, yeah, right. And then I'm like, oh, black cat, run away.
Yeah. Magic lives.
Don't walk that ladder.
Well, what about like in your personal life? Are you, you know, did you see yourself staying in LA? I mean, are your kids in the picture at any time?
You know, me and my lady are talking about going to Mexico City post vaccination.
Oh, nice.
Once we're all shot up. She works in food and agriculture, so she's got half the spice in her. She's getting the other.
Yeah,
my friend's a big David Lynch's Dune fan, so he keeps calling it the spice.
The spice. The spice.
The spice.
He just got
the spice. But once we are free to move about the world, we're itching to get out.
Yeah. I got my first dose this week. You know, it was like a weird thing where Gavin Newsom called production entertainment workers essential personnel, but they weren't really included in any of the official sort of vaccine releases. Mm. But then it just, I mean, I was getting it through production channels, through AD saying, you know, there's enough vaccine out there now that people are getting back, production people are getting vaccinated because they are technically essential personnel, like similar to, you know, Ralph's workers, right. You know, grocery store workers.
Right.
So I saw, you know, I got tipped off and there's like a place, you know, like a chain of health clinics that was given it to production people. And so
I went downtown and I found a bunch of syringes on the sidewalk and I go, there's the freaking vaccine.
This must be it.
Not.
Well, I've been taking your time. I've been taking your valuable promotional time that you could have been spending on Entertainment Tonight or something.
No, I love talking to you genuinely.
Oh, thank you. Me too. I was very excited that we were gonna do this. So I'm very happy we got to.
Yes, it's like, I mean, the majority of people I talk to are these like Mario Lopez type guys. You know what I mean? So
it's so
nice, like chatting with you.
Oh, good.
Who is like, you're so smart and comedic, and I value our friendship and I always run into you at restaurants.
Yes, that's right. Let's get to the third question. What's the point of the Eric Andre saga? What's it all mean? What have you learned?
The saga of my life. The saga of my life?
Well, you know, just like, what do you think the point of what you've been through is?
You know, I'm coming around to this. I've been so work obsessed for the past 20 years trying to like make a name for myself and make a career and get this movie out and get the show out and da 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 da. And like everything's been like work. And like now I'm in that existential crossroads where I'm like coming up to my 40s and I'm like, I think I need more of a work-life balance because life's not all about work. Life is about life, enjoying life. And I'm at a place now where I need to just like go for a walk or like start an herb garden. Maybe that sounds a little like corny and pedestrian, and maybe I'm letting my fans down because they want me to be this like hyperactive caveman 24 hours. But I'm too work obsessed. I'm like a version of my dad. My dad was a workaholic. So like I need to find the balance more.
Yeah. Well, that's a good, and being a work in progress is always important. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the time that it takes to bake your cake should be from the time from you're born to the time that you die. You know, it shouldn't like just be done and then you're done and like, well, no more growth, you know? So, and aging does, I mean, I'm 54. Aging makes, you're just a different person. And in many ways, I think a better person, just calmer. Shit doesn't ruffle your feathers like it used to. There's a lot of stuff that seemed real important that you realize is not important at all. And it's like, a fucking delight to be able to say, forget that bullshit, you know? It is really important. Inner youth. Yeah. Push. And, you know, and try and be famous, try and be rich. But then at a certain point that just is like, that just gives you a cushion so that you can discover yourself later, I think, so that you can get to the important stuff later. So, well, I can't wait to see this movie. I'm going to watch it tonight. And I love you and I love what you do. And I'm so glad I got to talk to you.
Likewise.
So, all right, everyone out there, watch Bad Trip and come back next week because I'll be talking to somebody else here on the Three Questions. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've got a big, big love.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at Breezeline.com.